You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Edgar B. Herwick III. Well, we've just went over the major headlines and bylines of the week, both the local and national news, a little bit of sports, and later on, Callie Crossley is going to take us below the fold of the newspaper and under the radar to touch on some of the hyper-local stories that you might have missed this week. So that just about covers it all, right? Wrong. The Earth is only a tiny little fraction of the intergalactic puzzle, and it's really this infinitesimally small fraction of the universe. So what about all the news that's happening in all of those other places? There's plenty of it, from near-Earth asteroids to life on Mars, even the end of the world. So here to help us sort of slip the surly bonds of Earth and look at what's happening up there in outer space is Kelly Beattie. He is the senior editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, Kelly.
Hey, thank you, Herwick. Great to be here.
All right. We're really happy to have you here. So I want to start by talking about this end of the world, the doomsday predictions, which is centering around the winter solstice. And some sort of conflation, or maybe it's not, between the winter solstice and the end of this long count period on a Mayan calendar. What's happening here?
Well, we need to understand a little bit about the Mayan calendar. And so we deal in terms of like centuries and millennia. Their longest unit of time was something called the long count, which was 5,126 years long.
Okay.
And in their culture, creation happened about the year 3114 BC. So you add those two together and you get 2012. The fact that it's December 21st is just pure coincidence. Now, the thing is, the Maya believe in multiple creations, and so they don't see this as the end of the world. In fact, there's nothing in any of their remaining records that we know about that says anything about this date coming up. But what we do know is that they believe that when one period ends, a new one begins. So they never, ever would have intended this to be the end of the world.
So this is kind of like us sort of looking at the Friday being the last day of the week or Saturday being the last day of the week and saying, once this week is over, the world is finished.
You know, the analogy I use a lot is on the odometer of your car.
Yeah.
Those of you of a certain age have had a car that rolled over 100,000 miles, and there's that little buzz that you get when all the nines turn to all zeros.
That's right. It's a brand new car.
Right. That's what's happening here. There's no consequence at all.
Mm.
So what has happened is that some people of a new age persuasion have taken this to be some sort of divination from the Maya trying to send us a message that something is going to happen. Maybe it's just positive enlightenment. Maybe it's catastrophe. Some authors have conjured up alignments with the center of the galaxy and planetary alignments that just don't exist, right? I get paid to do this for a living. There are no alignments. And so consequently, it's going to be a non-event. But I think it does give us a moment to talk about how the universe does work in cycles. I mean, we circle the center of the Milky Way every 250 million years. And other things happen that come and go, and it does give us a moment to try to appreciate what's going on in the cosmos and how things work, how that clockwork works.
So it's really interesting. Were the Mayans looking at their calendar by the stars? Were they using the stars to calculate time or not really at all? I mean, it's interesting that they get that we have Mayan calendar and then we've got all these consequences, which, like you said, tend to be sort of space related, right? The planets aligning, the poles shifting, the Earth's rotation going in the opposite direction suddenly. Were they using the stars to calculate their time?
In a word, no.
Yeah.
However, they were both really expert at keeping track of time. And they were really expert sky watchers at a time, and we're talking sort of 200 to 900 AD here. It was the Dark Ages in Europe.
Mm.
And yet here in the Western Hemisphere was this enlightened civilization that had a, you know, an alphabet of glyphs or little pictures of 1,000 characters. They knew that Venus returns to the same exact spot in the sky every 584 days. They knew what was going on. They had eclipse predictions and so forth. But as far as we know, they weren't using their calendar to predict astronomical events in that sense. So there's no real linkage there. One of the things that's just really tragic is that when the conquistadors came over to the New World, they believed that a lot of this glyph-based communication was the work of the devil. And so the bishop, the archbishop who came along, had everything burned except for three remaining documents. And all three of those involved astronomy. So we had to believe, based on that small sample, that astronomy was truly an important part of their lives.
But a lot of it lost, and we could have had a lot more.
Oh, if
really
only.
Interesting
if
stuff, huh?
only.
Really interesting. I'm talking with Kelly Beatty. He is the senior editor for Sky and Telescope magazine, and we're looking into the stars. And I want to look ahead at this month, and what's happening up there in the skies. The solstice obviously is a big event. It happens once a year. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about what that is, how important it is, you know, why it happens?
Sure. The solstice is a time when we sort of say this is the unofficial beginning of winter. And that solstice is an indication that the Earth is tipped away from the sun, at least the northern hemisphere, as much as it's going to be. So from our climatic perspective, the days are shortest. The sun is low in the sky. The sunlight is weak and it's very cold. So in the southern hemisphere, however, this is the beginning of summer for the Australians. You know, a lot of people think that seasons are caused because the Earth is closer or farther away from the sun, and that's not the case.
Right.
Actually, we're closest to the sun in early January.
Really?
So that's not it. That can't be it. It's really all about the tip of that axis, one way or the other, toward or away from the sun. So just so you know, the solstice occurs on the 21st, on that date, at 6:21 a.m., our time, Eastern time.
Okay.
And that means the days from that point forward will start getting longer. Daylight will start getting longer.
Big thumbs up to that.
And, you know, the thing is there's a lot of religious and just sort of folk mythology wrapped around that solstice. A lot of the legends that come forward speak to the beginning of the better days after the solstice. There's probably good reason that Christmas is timed to be near the time of solstice as the light coming forth. So solstice, in that sense, has many repercussions in our lives. Astronomically, it means that in 3 months, you know, we'll have the equinox when the sun is finally making its way northward of the equator. And then we can look forward to the other solstice, which happens in June, when the days are longest and nights shortest, at least for the northern hemisphere.
Yeah, you know, it kind of boggles your mind to think about the fact that, like, as you just said, you know, the difference between winter and summer is just the difference of it tilting just a little bit of our planet. In a universe as big as ours, it really gives you that sense of how small the window is of like living in a temperate climate. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, we're lucky beyond that in that we live on this planet. You were thinking big thoughts at the top of the show. How our Earth happens to be just positioned far enough away from the sun that water is, in its dominant form, is liquid, as opposed to a vapor if we were hotter, closer in, like at Venus, or frozen, like at Mars, where the water is plentiful there, but it's all frozen.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. We're talking with Kelly Beatty. He's senior editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. So what else is happening up there in the skies? If I'm a backyard telescope kind of fella and I want to look up there, is there anything interesting happening this month?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, as it gets dark at night, turn in the direction opposite where the sun sets and look halfway up. You cannot miss the planet Jupiter. It is the brightest thing in the sky. That big bright star is not a star. It's the planet Jupiter. So if you have any kind of optical equipment, good binoculars, small telescope, you can resolve Jupiter as a little white spot, not just a point of light. And also you might be able to make out the four largest moons called the Galilean satellites to either side of it, which are the ones that Galileo discovered and made famous in 1610. So Jupiter is sort of the anchor for what is beginning to be a dramatic arrival of the winter constellations over in the east. Below Jupiter, you'll be able to see the constellation Orion rearing up, the big mighty hunter with his three stars in his belt. To the side of Jupiter, not very far, you'll see, if you've got really good dark skies, a fuzzy little patch. Those are actually the stars of the Pleiades star cluster, which is beautiful in any pair of binoculars. They're like little diamonds on black velvet. The Pleiades have different names. It's the seven sisters. They're the seven daughters of Atlas. In Japanese, it's called Subaru. And wait a minute, Subaru.
Hey, wait a second.
Now, if you think about it, the logo for Subaru cars, as you watch them down the street, is a cluster, is a stylized star cluster. So there you go. The other thing I want to mention before we move on is that on the night of December 13th, that's a Thursday, we have a really nice meteor shower coming up called the Geminid Meteor Shower. And beginning at about 10 o'clock, once the constellation Gemini gets up over the horizon, we might see, if it's really dark, if you're in a good dark spot away from bright city lights, one meteor per minute. all night long, all through the rest of the night. The Geminids are one of the two or three very best meteor showers all year long. And because there's no moon in the sky right at that time, it should be a great show.
How does it work when, you know, we kind of come across a meteor shower? Is it that that's existing in space all the time and we just happen to be, the Earth happens to be passing past it in that moment? Is that what it is?
You're very good. You do well in my class, Edgar.
Yes.
So meteor showers, as opposed to regular, everyday, ordinary, random meteors, which are little bits of asteroid and comet that just happen to hit our atmosphere, meteor showers represent the orbit of some comet. And if you can imagine a picture, which I always use, of a dump truck full of sand running around a racetrack, and all the sand's flying out the back, right? It leaves a trail.
Yeah.
And that's what these comets do when they get near the sun. They bubble and fuss and fume, and they drop off a lot of gas and dust along their orbit. Every December, we plow through the orbit of a comet. It's known as 3200 Phaethon. It was originally thought to be an asteroid, but it's really a comet. And the dust from that is what peppers our atmosphere and creates these meteors. We have another one in August that's pretty famous called the Perseids, and a lot of people key on the Perseids in August. The Geminids in December and another shower called the Quadrantids in January, we'll talk about those next month, are the three best showers all year. So if it's not too cold that night of the 13th, bundle up yourself and the kids and head out, find a nice dark spot. Beginning about 10 o'clock at night, it should be a pretty good show.
Very cool. Kelly, you live around here. Are there places that if I want to go sort of check out something like a meteor shower that you recommend? Are there spots that are, you know, kind of good?
Well, all astronomical viewing at night is compromised by light pollution, which is really too bad. But it's just a 24/7 fact of life these days. Light pollution, to paraphrase the late great Tip O'Neill, light pollution is local.
And so if you can,
all light pollution is local. So if you can get away from your local shopping center or, you know, security lighting around a school or whatever, any park, you know, that has just a little clearing, like a baseball diamond or something that you can go crawl out into the middle of and shield yourself from the bright lights around you would be good. If you're stuck at home, go into your backyard and find a spot where there are no bright lights directly in your view. The thing about these meteors is they can appear anywhere in the sky.
Yeah.
So anywhere you can look where it's dark is a good place to look.
Very good. And I heard you saying earlier, talking about the Subaru, that you could see it with binoculars. So if you don't have a telescope, binoculars is a good idea?
Absolutely. And if you think about it, binoculars are two small telescopes strapped side by side.
Right.
And most people have them at home and have never thought to use them on the night sky. So you can use them on the Pleiades. You can use them on Jupiter. They're terrific on the moon. They resolve the craters and the, you know, the features that are there. I really encourage people to do that. You might want to try to stabilize them by leaning up against a wall or a tree or a post or something to make it a little more stable for you. But binoculars are a great first telescope.
Some good advice there. So we're talking about meteor showers, asteroids, things kind of passing. There's sort of a near-Earth asteroid, relatively near-Earth asteroid, that's also going to be – that's an event that's happening this week, as I understand, right?
Yeah, it's called Tutatis. It's a small asteroid just a couple of miles across. It's what's called an Earth crosser. It's one of a couple of thousand large asteroids that are somehow in a position to maybe someday collide with the Earth. This one is not. It's passing about 7 million miles away, very safely away.
Okay.
But it's in a special orbit that brings it back near the Earth every 4 years. And so two things are happening right now. For the standpoint of a backyard sky watcher, don't worry. It's going to be way too faint to find. If you've got a small telescope and want to try to track it down, you can go to skyandtelescope.com, our website, and we've got charts and such that will help you with that. There is a giant radio telescope out in California run by NASA that is already pinging this asteroid with radar waves and building up pictures of how it looks as it goes by. And also the Japanese have a spacecraft, Chang'e 2 is how you pronounce that. And that will be passing within a couple of hundred miles of this asteroid on the 11th, Tuesday night. And we hope to send back some really nice close-range pictures. The Chinese are a little bit secretive about their program, but something like this is one of their civilian satellites, and so we're hoping to get some nice pictures.
So this is like the movie Armageddon. They're going to fly up near the asteroid. They're not going to land on it, and they're not going to fly, right? It's a probe.
Edgar, I show Armageddon to my class to, as a final as a final test of how many things are wrong with it.
Really? We're not there yet?
And we're not there yet.
Although, I mean, you know, the president and others have talked about the idea of landing on an asteroid. Right? I mean, that is something that science is hoping to actually do.
I cannot wait. I mean, a lot of people talk about where next to go. Asteroids are just fascinating objects. They're little planets you can almost hold in the palm of your hand, so to speak. And they have potential for us in an economic sense because some of them are made up primarily of metal or have enough metal in them to make mining viable. There's a company called Planetary Resources mm-hmm. that just got started this past year that plans to actually do that. And we'll see where that goes.
A lot of big names in that company, too, like a lot of big money, right? You've got James Cameron, the filmmakers involved. Some of the guys from Google are involved, I believe. So this is a pretty serious endeavor.
It is a pretty serious endeavor. And you know, it's one of those things. NASA can't do it all. They just don't have the budget to do all the things that we'd like to do. Witness the emergence of space tourism, you know, rides into space on privately built space vehicles. I think the landscape is expanding rapidly, and there is plenty of room for these companies like Planetary Resources to pick up a niche and just fill it.
So I want to – you're talking about things that NASA can't do or can do, and certainly one of the things that brought NASA into everybody's consciousness was the Apollo missions and landing on the moon. And today is actually the 40th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 17, which was the final Apollo mission. And the last time that people were on the surface of the moon. So I actually want to play a little sound. We have a little sound from that event. This is the commander, Eugene Cernan. And this is his words on the surface of the moon after spending the final 7 hours and 15 minutes there, and he climbed back into the lunar module. Here's what he had to say.
We leave as we came, and God willing, as we shall return, with peace and in hope for all mankind.
So, Kelly Beatty, we haven't been to the moon in 40 years. Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Are we going to go back? Should we go back?
Well, when you say we, you mean humans.
Yeah, I do.
And I need to make that point because just 2 days ago, NASA released some amazing maps of the gravity field of the moon, collected by a couple of little robotic spacecraft that have been just zooming around every 2 hours since about this time last year. And the robotic exploration has gone on. We know tremendous amounts about the moon using really sophisticated spacecraft that have been able to photograph it. For example, we have now photographed all the landing sites of Apollo. If there was any ever doubt that we actually landed.
Conspiracy theorists.
this spacecraft called Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter has disproved those. I mean, the landing sites exist. The hardware is there. You can see the tracks of the rovers and everything. So getting back to the moon with people, especially knowing how capable our robots are, is going to be a long sell. There are certainly people who support that. And I have friends in the business, planetary explorers and scientists who would just love to go back to the moon. I think there's a bigger bang for the buck in the very short term going to asteroids. This is totally new territory. It would be dramatic. It would be fantastic. At the longer term end, I think Mars is the place to go. It's the place most like the Earth. It's the place that we want to know about more.
Speaking of places that we've gone to, want to know more about, where there's debate about whether a manned mission should go or not, but a place we are sending rovers and non-manned vehicles is Mars. And we had a recent sort of announcement from NASA about Mars where they kind of grabbed some of the soil there with the rover that's there right now and baked it up in their little lab, which is on board. And it showed traces of organic compounds. We saw carbon, we saw chlorine. It sounds like there's a little bit of a, well, not so fast, but it could be potentially an indicator of microbes. What's happening there real quick?
Yeah, the real quick part is that those chlorinated methane molecules that they found, a very simple organic molecule, is probably a byproduct of the testing process. That molecule probably does not exist on Mars itself and is simply an aspect of having been cooked. The other aspect to it is that the chlorine almost certainly comes from Mars. The surface is permeated with this compound called perchlorate, which is really nasty stuff. That's for sure. Where the carbon comes from is still the unanswered question. It could be a contaminant that was just carried inside the instrument from Earth. The scientists are trying to work that out right now.
Will they be able to work that out?
They will. And in fact, this experiment that you're talking about, aboard Curiosity, it's like a little CSI lab on wheels. It's great. We'll be able to determine whether there are organic compounds, not only in the Mars of today, but because it's going to be testing some really ancient sediments at the base of this giant mountain that it's ultimately headed toward, could find out whether there were organic compounds there billions of years ago, when Mars, we understand, was a lot better place from the standpoint of life than it is today.
Now, there you have it. That is Kelly Beatty, Senior Editor for Sky and Telescope Magazine. Thank you for taking us up into the stars this afternoon here on our sort of intergalactic look ahead at the month.
Hey, Edgar, this is great. Keep looking up, okay?
Thanks. And as I look up now, not far from me, another star, Callie Crossley.
Thank you, Edgar. Well, we're bringing the conversation back to Earth with a look at some of the local stories that went under the radar this week.
Are you sure that they went under the radar? The Chinese probe that's tracking the asteroid might have detected a few of those stories.
We're all being watched, Edgar.
There you have it. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III.
I'm Callie Crossley. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, Space, the Final Frontier.